Good morning and welcome to this December 4th, 2013 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting to you live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. I'm your guest host, Marie Stone. We are here each and every week, Wednesday mornings at 9 a.m. with authors, poets, agents, giving you all the latest information on the publishing world and our latest and greatest novels. I'm joined this morning by Wally Lamb, author of the novel We Are Water. And coming up in the second half hour, T.C. Boyle will be here to discuss his latest collection, Stories 2. Wally Lamb is the author of four previous novels, including the New York Times national bestseller, The Hour I First Believed, and Wishin' and Hopin', a bestselling Christmas novella. His first two works of fiction, She's Come Undone and I Know This Much Is True, were both number one New York Times bestsellers and selections of Oprah's book club. Wally edited Couldn't Keep It to Myself and I'll Fly Away, two volumes of essays from students at his writing workshop at York Correctional Institution, a women's prison in Connecticut, where he has been a volunteer facilitator for 15 years. He was on the show with me in 2007 talking about those. His latest novel is We Are Water. It's published by Harper, and it's the subject of our conversation this morning. Wally, welcome.
Hey, Marie. It's good to be back with you.
I should say welcome back. That's right. Thanks for coming back on.
Sure.
So tell us about this novel, where it came from, how it came to be, and all your inspirations for it.
Well, you know, I would have to take you back to 2009. I was promoting Wishin' and Hopin', which had just come out, and I did a radio interview with my hometown radio station, and that is Norwich, Connecticut. And at the end of the interview, the guy who was I was talking to said, "So what's next for Wally Lamb?" And I had no idea, but I didn't want to say that, so I said, "Well, maybe I'll write about the flood." And if you're from Norwich, you know that the flood, it refers to the devastating flood of 1963, where a dam at the northern end of the town collapsed and unleashed about 6 million gallons of water, devastated property along the way, including the downtown, and more horrifically, it killed 5 people. And so one thing led to another, and in fact, I did start writing about that flood. And I used, as an example, or as a template, I guess I would say, the story of a family that actually lived, nonfiction, in the town, and they lost their mom. 3 little boys, ages 4, 2, and infant, lost their mom, and then their dad to alcoholism after that, and so I started there and began to fictionalize, and it turned into We Are Water.
Hmm. You were talking at some point about how this work was also inspired by some of your work with the prisoners, and I was wondering how much of your work with these women has influenced some of your own work, some of your own thinking.
Well, Marie, big time. It's had a big influence on my work and also my education. You know, I went down there almost 15 years ago, intent on teaching the women how to write their stories. But they gave me an education as well, and continue to do so. And unfortunately, one of the things that correlates between with women in prison is having been incest victims when they were kids. And so I have been on the receiving end of a lot of very frank and very brave accounts of childhood experiences that were certainly a lot less than perfect, and that sort of has bled into this story. Now, you know, I don't take any of the students' stories and turn it, you know, into my novel, but as I said, it gave me an education. In my previous novel, The Hour I First Believed, it follows the victim of one of the Columbine shooting, and the women taught me the women at the prison taught me so much about post traumatic stress disorder, which the majority suffer from various things, and so they gave me a knowledge about that as well.
Mm. Yeah, one thing that was occurred to me the last time we spoke, and it continues to occur to me, is how therapeutic writing is. And I know you're a big proponent of that for these women. And I was wondering if the therapy if you can tell as teacher, if you can tell as writer in your own work, when the writing is therapy versus when the writing is art, and if the therapeutic part of writing sort of gets in the way of the artistic part of writing, or if it gets in the way of the story, and if you can tell that in the women's writing. Does that make
sense? I think so, yeah. First of all, I have to I have to declare that I am certainly not a therapist, but I do see the therapeutic effect of the writing. Not only the fact that the women will sort of unleash these terrible secrets that they've kept hidden for many years, but also that they will share them not only with me but with the other people in the class. And I think it is that kind of unburdening, and then hearing from others that they had similar experiences. I think that's what is key to the therapy. Suddenly, you're not alone with this terrible thing that you've been harboring anymore, and it lightens the load. And I see that play out in the women's attitudes. Women who, you know, couldn't look you in the eye at the beginning of their work in the program, now have become leaders of the program, and they're as far as therapy versus art, you know, the therapeutic effect, I think, comes from that first draft, and once they realize, once they find their voice, and they realize that these stories are important and need to be heard, then they become very interested in making them good enough to go public. And so that's where the craft comes in. That's where, you know, they will give each other very useful feedback in terms of additions, deletions, clarifications, and reordering.
Hmm. I love that. I love that. Yeah, I think... yeah, your own work reflects so well the empathy for these characters.
Thank you.
It's really nice. As you look across sort of the arc of your work now and the number of novels that you've written, do you see kind of recurring themes, the areas of concern for you as writer and maybe, you know, just as human being?
Yeah, you know, I've been at it for as long as our oldest child has been born. I started writing fiction the same month that he came into our lives. And Jared is now 32, so I've been at it for a while, and I've written these five novels. And I hate to sound like my own Cliff Notes or Spark Notes, but I do see recurring themes. It's not that that I'm conscious of them necessarily while I'm concocting these stories, but I would say probably the common denominator is the effect of power and often the misuse of power on the powerless. And you know, when I was a high school teacher for about 25 years, and bullying by one student toward another student was always, you know, very, you know, something that I reacted to very strongly. And I think that probably carries over into the novels, because whether it's governments or, you know, societies or, you know, prison wardens or, you know, abusive husbands or whatever, I really fight against, that sort of immoral use of power.
Yeah, yeah. My guest this morning is Wally Lamb. The book is We Are Water. And let's talk a little bit about your characterizations and getting in the minds of these characters. You write from several points of view in this novel. And I'm wondering if you stay, how well do you get to know a character, stay in their point of view before you switch to another character's point of view and mind them? Is this sort of chronologically written, or do you, you know, really go deep into a character for a long period of time before you switch over to another character?
Well, Marie, I would have to say first off the bat that although I'm somewhat envious of the kind of writers who can sort of map out the story or come up with an outline before they write the chapters, and you know, the kind of writer who can write toward a preconceived ending, it never works that way for me. I slip out of my own skin. I become these characters right in their point of view, and just see where the story is going. So where this story went in about the first year or so of a 4-year slog, that I was writing in tandem between a husband and a wife, an ex-husband and ex-wife. Orion O, who is a psychologist working at a university with undergraduates, and his wife Annie O, who is she is an outsider artist, and so she leaves the marriage to marry a woman. Gay marriage has just been legalized in Connecticut when the story is set, and so I was going back and forth between their two points of view about how and why the marriage had failed, and you know what the history of that marriage had been, and so forth. And in the middle of doing that, for as I say, for about a year, suddenly other characters began to demand to speak. Among them are their three children, who are all in their 20s when the marriage falls apart, and Annie makes the decision to marry Vivica. And so I, you know, that had not been planned, but they have adult twins who are in their 20s, fraternal twins, a male and a female, and then the twins have a younger sister, and they all insisted that I take the gag off so that they can tell the family story from their points of view.
And you wrote for a little while from the point of view of the I don't want to give too much away, but there's a sexual predator in the book that you wrote from the point of view of. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah,
accessing
well,
the heart of people.
It's obvious to me, both through her art, you know, the kind of art that she makes, and also through her, you know, interior monologue, that Annie is keeping a big, deep, dark secret, something from childhood, and that is that she was incested by an older cousin. Her mother dies in a flood, and this older cousin is sort of the only person who is more or less around in the household, and he begins to, again, take that, that terrible abuse of power over this little girl. And, so Annie grows up, and, she is haunted by what happened. Now the character, the predator is, her cousin Kent, and, she sort of has him in her head throughout, you know, the first couple of sections of the novel, and then he emerges as a character and begins to tell his story as well. And it was very, very uncomfortable for me to write in Kent's point of view. But I, you know, again, this harkens back to my work with the prison students, because I have heard so often from the point of view of the victim in these situations, that I began to be sort of reluctantly curious about, you know, who the predator is and what's his backstory, and, you know, what kind of, you know, self-delusions is he under, what kind of manipulation does he use, and so forth. So as uncomfortable as it was to speak as Kent, I felt that I needed to do that for the sake of the story.
Was he your most difficult character?
Yeah, by far. Yeah, I mean, I would finish my work for the day and you know, run upstairs and take a shower to sort of wash Kent off. He really creeped me out, and yet, in an odd way, because I discovered his backstory, I'm not entirely unsympathetic to him. One of the things that I have learned over the years is that, you know, there is a lot more gray in people's lives than just black and white. You know, that nobody, none of us, I think, is all good or all bad. And so I had a sort of a sympathy for Kent, given that this is the burden of his life, that he has these uncontrollable urges. You know, in no way do I excuse, you know, what he does or what any sexual predator does, but I felt like I better understood what the you know, what the obsession was all about.
But that always leads me to the question that I ask about whether the novel changed your own mind about anything. So it sounds like it did.
Yeah, I mean, I already knew that it's a pretty complicated equation, you know, crime and punishment. But I think probably that lesson was reinforced. You know, a lot of I'll do a lot of book groups, and when a book group chooses the book that I did with my prison students, every once in a while I'll be challenged, and they will say, "Oh, I really liked that person through her writing, and then I got on the internet and I found out what she did, and I didn't know how to feel because she had done something so terrible." And I will say to somebody who says that, "Yeah, well, don't forget that the prosecutor has one version of the truth, and the defense attorney has another version of the truth, and probably the truth is somewhere in the middle. So, it's not all just cut and dried or black and white."
Yeah, right. My guest this morning is Wally Lamb. The book is We Are Water. I want to switch over to a couple of crafty questions. Mm-hmm. All of your novels are heavy, physically heavy, like big, thick novels. And, the challenge that always strikes me in big novels is structure and not getting lost in the forest from the trees with all the revision process. I'm sure that it's hard to keep sort of, 500 to 800 pages in your head of, what got cut and does it still make sense and does it still flow through? And I've read it so many times. So if we can talk a little bit about the revision process, what that looks like, how you organize yourself. I know you don't use an outline, but kind of how you keep yourself organized.
Yeah, and I sometimes get to that outline after I have, most of the first draft fleshed out. The longest novel that I wrote was my second one, and that's called I Know This Much Is True. And I had no idea that I was gonna paint on so wide a canvas, if you will. And I remember sitting in my office and sort of writing out a story map, kind of like what they do in the movies. And I put the story on index cards that I then masking taped to the wall so that I could see it visually. And that helped to sort of get wrap my head around the entire arc of the story. In terms of my novels being so heavy, in a literal sense, all those pages stacked together, I have to share with you an anecdote. I was once in a signing line or signing books, and a little old lady came up to me and she said, "I love your books, but they're too heavy." And I said, "Oh, I know, they're so god awful long, aren't they?" And she said, "No, I didn't say too long, I said too heavy." She said, "I like to read with the book resting on my stomach in bed, and your books hurt my stomach." So I said, "Well, sorry about that." And she said, no, I've discovered a solution, and you can pass this on to your other readers." She said, "When I'm finished a page on both sides, I just rip it out of the book so that the further I get into the story, the lighter the book gets." So I thought I would pass that on as a technique.
For book lovers, that hurts my heart. But
yeah, right, I know.
So tell me what this wall looks like. I'm still curious about this. So it's a lot of post-it notes. Like, do you color code? Because it strikes me, there aren't too many characters in this book, but, kind of following the arc of a character, the arc of a story, the arc of a symbol. Do you color code it where you say, "We haven't heard from Annie in a little while," or "We need more Kent here," or I don't know.
Yeah, well, that was true. That was more true of the Hour I First Believed than the long novel that I wrote prior to this one, and I did color code. I went to Staples. I got a bunch of different colored index cards, and I literally, did exactly that. I had little chapter summaries for each index card, and different colors for each character, and then I just sort of slapped it on the wall, so that I could see, what the deficiencies were, or, where I needed to go, and that kind of thing. This process for We Are Water was a little bit more intuitive than that. That process is about structuring, and with this one, I would just show up at the computer every day downstairs in my office to see who was going to speak next, and so it wasn't so. It wasn't so much a strategy as a kind of a book that was put together by impulse.
Yeah, I guess that brings me to my other question, which is there sort of a defined process, or every book is its own animal, and you're really starting over every time you start a new novel?
Yeah, for me it is. When I finished She's Come Undone, my first novel, I thought, aha, oh, this is great. Not only did I complete a novel, but it's going to get published. I must know how to do it. And And then I sat down to write my second novel, and it's like, whoa, all I learned was how to do that first novel. And I have a hard time starting novels. Once I'm in the groove, once the rhythm and the pace gets going and I get to know these characters and start worrying about them, you know, I'm good to go. But for me, I have to keep starting that car before it'll go.
It sounds like an analogy to raising kids. You know, once you have it down, they're either a new age or the thing that worked on one kid doesn't work on the other kid. I guess novels are like that, right?
Yeah, we have three sons, and number one is nothing. Raising number two was nothing like raising number one, and number three is our adopted son, and boy, did he ever change all the rules of parenting that we thought we had down. So yeah, at least for our family, that analogy really works.
My guest this morning is Wally Lamb. The book is We Are Water. Can you read just a few minutes to us? Because I always love to hear the author's voice inside.
Sure.
Inside the world.
Yep. Let me read first of all from Orion, maybe a paragraph, and then if there's time, I'd like to read a paragraph from Annie, his one-time wife.
Mm, perfect.
This is Orion speaking. He says, looking back, I'm amazed at how much in denial I was about her and Vivica. I mean, yeah, I'd get worried from time to time, but what I thought was that maybe she'd gotten involved with some other guy. I would imagine him, worry about him, even sometimes picture her walking hand in hand with him in New York, some artist or musician type, some lanky younger guy with a pork pie hat and a couple of days' worth of stubble. But the only time I confronted her about another man, she got huffy. Said it was all about her work and that my insecurity was my problem, not hers. And hey, whenever I called her, she was almost always there where she was supposed to be, either at the studio or at night at Vivica's apartment. I still don't know when they made the switch from roommates to lovers. Annie has told me it happened over time, that the affair was not premeditated. And I believe her, but it's interesting, isn't it? The way she put it, premeditated, as if it was a crime, which it was in a way. It was the murder of our marriage. So that's from his point of view. This is a paragraph or so from Annie's point of view. The truth, whether Orion believes it or not, is that I hadn't left him for Vivica. I had left him for New York, for the opportunities it offered me, creatively and commercially. What developed between Vivica and me had been unplanned. My defection, Orion had called it, on that awful Sunday back in Connecticut, when I finally admitted that Vivica and I had become involved, that I had fallen in love with her. I was a Judas, he said. I could get my own damn ride back to the train station because he sure as hell wasn't going to take me there. He was through being a sap. I had had to hire a cab to New Haven, and on the train ride back to the city, I kept replaying our argument. Well, if I was Judas, then that made him Jesus Christ, right? Well, maybe he should come down from his cross and take some responsibility for the fact that our marriage had failed.
That's fantastic. That was Wally Lamb reading from his latest novel, We Are Water. We're drawing down on our time, but I wanted to give you a chance to chat about writing advice that you give the women that you work with or that you give other students, maybe common mistakes that you see them make and the advice that you give them.
Mm-hmm. There was a writing teacher named Dorothea Brand. She wrote and taught in the 30s and 40s. And in her book, which I think is called On Becoming a Writer, she described the writing process in this way. She said, the writer has to be both the child and the adult. The child is lost in the ego and can go wherever he wants to go. She can, sort of create or imagine without any rules. And the adult, of course, is responsible and concerned not only with herself or himself, but also with other people. And so she said, when you are drafting, when you are creating, Don't be the adult, be the child, and go where you want or need to go, where you're, what you're curious about. Don't worry about censoring, don't worry about spelling, that kind of thing. But then, of course, you can't be only the willful child. In later drafts, you have to be the more responsible adult and worry about clarity and whether or not you you're communicating to others. And I love that. I love that that sort of comparison. And that's that's what happens. I think if you try to be the adult too soon in the writing, you get sort of choked off. And if you don't later on become the adult, you are apt to fail in what you're trying to communicate with your writing.
That actually goes great full circle with what we were talking about at the top of the hour, with, writing as therapy, and then you get kind of the therapy part of it out of the way, and then the editor comes in and hones the craft and makes the art out of, out of the traumatic experience. That's really nice.
Bingo. Yeah, that's okay. Exactly how it works for me. And I also work in writers' groups, and I find that both getting and giving feedback is a very important part to my process.
Yeah, wonderful. We covered a lot. Did we cover everything we should have? Are there things that we should
have talked
about?
I think so, Marie. You are a damn good interviewer. I appreciate that.
You're very sweet, very sweet. It was such a pleasure to have you back on. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and best luck to you, and happy holidays.
You too. You too.
Okay.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
That was Wally Lamb, the author of We Are Water. You can find him at wallylamb.com. There's a lot of great stuff on there. We're going to take an minute break, but when we come back, T.C. Boyle will be with me. Stay tuned. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine.
I find this scientifically fascinating.
You're listening to KUCI Irvine.
Disengage this computer now.
Broadcasting at 88.9 FM.
Hello, computer.
And on the web at kuci.org.
The most reliable computer ever made.
And streaming through iTunes.
Don't expect any mercy during the Great Robot Wars.
Anteater Radio brought to you by machines. Returning to normal broadcast in 3, 2, 1.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. We are at iTunes. You can find us under College Radio. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series, events, and more. We're taking a couple of months off, I think, from the speaker series events, but they start back up again in 2014. They are always fantastic, so check us out there. They always sell out. I'm your guest host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. I'm joined now by T.C. Boyle. T.C. is incredibly prolific. He's the author of 14 novels, including World's End, winner of the Penn Faulkner Award, Drop City, a New York Times bestseller, and a finalist for the National Book Award. The Women, he was on with me a couple years ago, the New York Times bestseller, and most recently San Miguel. He's also written 9 short story collections. In 1999, he was the recipient of the Penn Malamud Award for Excellence in Short Fiction. He's a member of the American Academy of Arts and Letters. He lives near Santa Barbara in a fantastic Frank Lloyd Wright house. He's the distinguished professor of English at USC, and his latest tome is Stories Number 2, and it's my pleasure to welcome him back on. T.C., hello.
Yeah, hi, Marie.
How are you?
Great. You know, this fine old house you're talking about is pretty cold this morning. It was down into the 40s.
Oh, my God. Yeah, I'll bet it is. I'll bet it is. So I'm going to let you talk both about San Miguel and this latest collection that you've put out, part 2 to the collection that came out in the 1990s, and the genesis of these stories, the genesis of San Miguel, and take us back into your world.
Absolutely great. Well, the previous novel was When the Killing's Done. That was 2011. Last year was San Miguel, which is now out in paperback. And When the Killing's Done takes place on Santa Cruz and Anacapa Islands off of Santa Barbara here, and it's set now, and it's about the ecology And while I was doing that, I discovered two historical pieces, one a memoir and one a fragmentary autobiography, and I felt I had to address those. So that became the novel San Miguel, which is about two families which lived on this island, one in 1888, the other in the 1930s, as sole possessors of it, making their living as sheep ranchers.
You, the thing that I love about you is that there's no subject matter that you won't take on. There's no time period or no person, or, you know, your work is very experimental. I'm wondering if this makes you think the problem with other authors is they're too limited or too safe, or they, you know, too much write what they know.
Come on, Marie. I'm not going to diss my fellow authors. We're all in it together. Everybody, every artist goes his or her own way and does what they want to do. Yes, I understand what you're saying. Sometimes, particularly with autobiographical writers, the stories may seem sort of similar. I've never really had that problem. I don't write much from an autobiographical perspective, although in T.C. Boyle's Stories 2, this fat 915-page collection, there are a couple that are autobiographical, or at least begin with an autobiographical idea. An example would be the title story of the last section, A Death in Kitchewank, about the death of my close friend's father. Another is the final story in the book, Burnham Wood. I lived in that house, and I was not exactly that man who doesn't properly appreciate his woman, but close.
That's great. Are there places that you won't go? Is there any place
Of course, you know, I am a free agent living in America. God bless us, and I can say and do anything I want. There are two exceptions, though. I can't write stories about previous girlfriends or my wife's family.
That's a good rule.
Otherwise, I'll go anywhere.
I should write that down for myself. That's a good rule. And, you know, you've got so much humor and whimsy, you know, both in real life and in the stories. Do you find that it sort of translates the same way as writing humor, just kind of a natural style of your voice? Do you have to work at that at all in your work, or does it just come out organically?
I'll take choice B on that one. I like to say that I'm just doing what comes natural. I think every writer finds a voice and a persona and channels it. So I don't work at being funny or work at not being funny. The stories just happen, and you could have a very funny story, and it might be the very next one in the sequence that I've written might be something very dramatic and passionate.
Yeah. It's interesting to look over kind of the arc of, I guess, so the stories start in 1994. They go pretty recently, so, you know, 15 years. 20 years almost, right? As you look...
Yeah, okay, so, excuse me, T.C. Boyle Stories collects all the stories I'd written up till 98. Now, some of these all have dates, so some of these were not in that collection, and so there's a little holdover. But basically, we're looking at the stories from the late 90s on until this past year. The most recent one in here, Sick Transit, was just in Harper's this October.
Right. And as you look over sort of the evolution of yourself as writer in this collection and in all of the collections, how have your areas of concern changed as writer or as human, and can you kind of track it through the course of your work?
Well, Marie, you know, I used to be a young man. Now I'm an extremely old man. And so I guess I might have matured a little bit in terms of my stories. If you look at the first collection, and by the way, there's a preface to this book in which I look back over my career and talk about such things. I think, on the whole, in the earlier stories, I was much more interested in design, language, and idea than I was in character. But over the course of my life, having written so much and so many novels, I think I've worked more with character in these more recent stories than I did in the previous ones. That said, there's still a wonderful mix, I think, of realistic, as we said, even a couple of semi-autobiographical stories, of absurdist stories, tall tales, fall-down funny stories, funny where it catches in the back of your throat kind of stories. But to me, anything can be a story. Anything you tell me, anything I read in the newspaper, my mind just works in this way. Well, what would that be like? You know, for instance, a newspaper article might tell us what happened to whom and when it happened. But how did they feel about it? You know, what were they thinking? That's what stories do for me.
Yeah. Do you have any rules? You seem like a man without writing rules, and you're very experimental and willing to go anywhere. But do you find that there are rules that need to govern how you govern your writing?
No, there are no rules whatsoever. And any of these textbooks that purport to tell you rules of how to write stories, it doesn't work. In fact, if someone imposed rules on me, I would spend all of my resources and every bit of talent I have trying to subvert the rules. It's just not the way it works. But of course, I'm a craftsman and a perfectionist, and I want to make the story as good as it can be, and so I'm rewriting it over and over as I move along. Once it's finished, though, and set, that's it. It's a moment in history. So that, for instance, one of my heroes in this is the late John Updike, who published the first volume of his collected stories a few years back. And in his preface, he said that he looked at his old stories, and he couldn't help rewriting them as he went along. I don't do that. I wouldn't do that. In both these volumes of collected stories, these stories exist in their time. I'm perfectly happy with the way that I produce them and what they say and how they are. I don't reject. If I rejected any of them, I wouldn't have included them. For better or worse, whoever's interested, this was a story that was written in 2009 or 1998. And obviously, sometimes the references are dated, of course. Anything we do is a matter of history.
Right, right. My guest this morning is T.C. Boyle. The book is Stories 2, and his novel now out in paperback is San Miguel. You've talked about the need to write linearly and that, writing a story from start to finish, and how you see a lot of students getting stuck when they start saying, you know, now I really, this kitchen scene is coming up 200 pages, but I really don't want to write what's in front of me, so I'll write that scene. And I see a lot of writer friends doing that as well. Kind of talk about the importance of writing from start to finish.
Again, there are no rules, and everyone works differently. And I'm not going to prescribe any kind of method. I can only describe what I do. Everybody in every story or novel will hit a wall. Usually this is a third of the way in or halfway through. You begin in a burst of enthusiasm, and things are coming to you, and you're seeing things and translating them into language, and you're seeing how the story develops and so on. But at some point, you don't know where it's going or what it is or what it means or what your themes are or why you're doing this, and that's always very difficult. I had a very hard time with San Miguel in this regard, for instance. I almost gave up on it because I forced myself into a mode that's not natural to me. It's a long narrative that is non-comic and non-ironic. Could I do this? It's entirely from the point of view of women. I'm glad I stuck with it and made certain small discoveries that enabled me to get through to the end, but I would never write out of sequence. That's not organic. It's as if, you know, you were to think of a great metaphor while you're walking down the street and write it down on a card and then try to fit it in a story somewhere. That doesn't work. All of that has to happen in the moment of composition. Yes, you can refine it and write it over and over, but otherwise you'll have something that is non-organic and artificial.
Right, right, right. You brought up thinking about abandoning that project, and I was wondering if there is a point in time when you're writing that you have decided to abandon a project, and what sort of leads you to that conclusion?
I never have, except maybe very early in my career. I got to a certain point, and the stories that I collected in my very first collection, Descent of Man, which is part of T.C. Boyle Stories, the original one, those are 17 stories, and I'd probably published about 30 at that time. I was still a student at the Iowa Writers Workshop, and I wrote full stories that I published and looked back on and felt where they're kind of my juvenilia and my apprenticeship stories, and they're not really what I want to be known for, and so I've never collected them. Since then, though, rather than write an entire story that's not going to work, I think I've learned that within a page or two that this is not working for me for whatever reason, and then I will abandon it. So every story you see in T.C. Boyle Stories 2, and there are 58 of them over these fat 915 pages, everyone is what I wrote in its sequence, in its time, and none were abandoned.
That's great. That's great. My guest this morning is T.C. Boyle. Can you read to us for a few minutes? Because I know you, you're a great reader of your own work, and it's so fun to hear authors' voices inside their own stuff. Can you read to us?
I'd be happy to. In fact, I don't know how much time we have, but I'd like to read the entire book over the air.
That would be great. We'll be here until next week.
No, actually, how about if I read three paragraphs? Would that
That's perfect.
Do it?
That's perfect.
Something like that, yeah. Okay. Maybe even, what if I read four paragraphs?
I like it.
Okay, good. This is the first story in the new section of the book, which is an entirely new collection called The Death in Kitchwank. This story is the first one in the sequence. It's called My Pain is Worse Than Your Pain. I like my wife fine, and we had a pretty smooth run of it over the years, but there was a sort of, what do I want to say here? Expectedness to the days that sometimes bore down on me till I felt like a piece of furniture that hasn't been moved in a lifetime. An end table, maybe, made of maple, with some fine beveling that serves no other purpose than to collect dust. Which is why, and I'm not making excuses, just stating the facts, I pulled on my black jeans and turtleneck, dug my ski mask out of the closet, and climbed up the backside of Lily Barron's cabin to the patch of roof where her deck projects on the second floor, and peeped in the window with no other intention but to see what she was doing at 11:45 at night, and maybe, if that was what she wanted, to surprise her, give her a little jolt, in the best possible sense, that is, by way of amiability and with the promise of mutual enjoyment. You see, Lily's had it rough this past year. She's only 43, but Frank, her husband, who's no longer with us, was in his 60s. And when he retired, she quit her job as a legal secretary and came up here to Big Timber to live out the rest of her days in tranquility amidst the giant sequoias. They built their dream house on the double lot Frank had bought back in the 80s and became full-timers, or dream cabin, I should say, since the 28 of us who live here year-round, as well as the 50 or so part-timers, like to think of ourselves as roughing it. And while a couple of us do have actual log cabins built from kits out of actual peeled logs, most of us settle for houses with alpine touches, like cedar paneling, stone fireplaces, and mounted animal heads over our hand-hewn mantelpieces. To a man, woman, and child, we call them cabins. Frank volunteered for Neighborhood Watch and helped out in winter with snow removal. And Lily, with her heartbreaking face and a figure unruined by childbearing because she'd borne no children, not to Frank, or her previous husband, who, I understand, worked for the Forest Service over at Mineral King before he drank himself senseless and pitched headlong over the rail of the fire lookout, began organizing potlucks and bridge nights down at the lodge, that sort of thing. And she began drinking more than was probably good for her, as did Frank. This, and we've all joked about it, is just one of the hazards of living in a fishbowl community at 7,200 feet and a good twisting break-eating hour from the nearest town in a place of natural beauty so all-encompassing God might have thought to set it aside for his wife if he ever bothered to get married. Anyway, Frank liked nature, liked the hills, and despite his age, he was always out there hiking no matter the weather. You'd look up from the fire, or the TV, or your first double vodka and tonic on a snow-bleared winter morning, and there he'd be, with his day pack and alpenstock, heading off into the woods without a thought as to trails, compasses, or the weather. And if he had a cell phone, it really wouldn't have mattered, since the reception up here is what they indicated the call failed indicator for. He went out one spring afternoon with his fly rod and a day pack containing a pint of Jim Beam and two cream cheese and olive sandwiches Lily had sealed in plastic wrap, and he never came back. As they later reconstructed it, he was fishing Hellbore Creek for goldens when he must have taken a tumble because his leg was broken in two places. Well, with his eyes gouged out by the ravens and the way the bear had frolicked with the corpse, no one could be sure. He'd been missing 4 days by the time search and rescue found him, the sandwiches gone along with the soft stuff of his eyes and the bourbon drawn down to less than a finger in its intact glass shell. Lily said she was sure he'd suffered, and we all tried to reassure her, citing the solace of the bourbon, the soothing rhapsody of the stream, and the sun that made way for the stars as if to give him a glimpse of eternity when the nights came on. but privately, we knew she was right.
That's T.C. Boyle reading from Stories 2, My Pain is Worse Than Your Pain. That story had a genesis, so you just kind of heard a snippet of that story and then kind of took it and ran.
Yeah, absolutely. I spend a lot of time up in the Sequoia National Forest. It's a place that I really love up there, a small community. And I had heard of some new people. And, of course, everyone, as you've heard from the story, does tend to drink a lot up there because it's very boring and what else are you going to do? And at a party, the man of the new couple kind of developed an attachment for a married woman there and surprised her in just this way. And so I ran with it and created this story.
So when you hear these stories that sort of intrigue you, do you jot down the germ of the idea, and then when you have some time, when your novels are done, you kind of go to this notebook, or how does it, or do you just kind of collect these things in your own mind as to things you want to come back to?
Yes, I just jot down a sentence or two, nothing too elaborate because I don't want to elaborate until I get there. So that, for instance, I've just finished a new novel called The Harder They Come. It's set in Northern California, it's set now, and it's about American violence. The notion of how come every schizophrenic in America has to have an automatic weapon, you know. So it's a kind of counterpoint to San Miguel, the quiet novel of being trapped on an island from a women's point of view. This is primarily from a men's point of view, and it's contemporary and somewhat violent. I mean, somebody gets shot in this book, which is unusual for me. And so that's finished and delivered just before I went on tour for this book. And now I'm just starting the first of the new stories. And I have a little sheet of paper in front of me, which might have 12 or 14 ideas. And I see how they will go. I'll look at them for a minute and think about them. Maybe a line will come to me. Maybe I'll dismiss it. Maybe I'll go on to the next one. And I think I've finally settled on one. And I'm only just beginning it. I'm only 3 pages in, but I think it will work.
Mm. Do you stick with a novel all the way through before you move on to a short story, or can you kind of mix your
genre? No. Medias? Again, as we were saying earlier, Marie, I don't think, you know, you want to write the kitchen scene out of sequence. I think I don't want to be distracted by other things. So no, no matter how difficult it is, I always fight through. And there's a time for novels and there's a time for stories. I've not yet had the experience of having a story idea and expanding it to a novel, or vice versa, having a larger idea and bringing it down to a story. I'm pretty much fairly rigid. And if I'm looking back on my career here, my first book is a collection of stories, Descent of Man. The next two books are novels, Water Music and Budding Prospects. Water Music, historical, and Budding Prospects, contemporary. And if I look back, in sequence, that's how all my books have gone. A book of stories, a historical novel, a contemporary novel, a book of stories, etc. And I'm hoping to continue that trend.
Hmm. How much research is involved, given the amount of ground you cover?
Well, you know, I have probably talked to you before about how much I hate technology and resent the fact that the machines dominate our lives and rule us. And I love to unplug now and again rather than be obsessed all the time with this. But the internet is a pretty great thing for a novelist. While writing anything, I probably go into the internet 10 times to get a fact or a name. Again, I have tremendous discipline. I don't get distracted reading, you know, this other crap in there. I just find what I need and get out. So that is very helpful. But as far as a larger book, for instance, the one I've just finished, The Harder They Come, has some historical sequences within this contemporary novel, and they're about the mountain men of the past, and very specifically one of them called John Coulter. And so I just read some texts about him. He's legendary. There are many stories about him, and selected the ones I wanted. So it all depends. The Frank Lloyd Wright book, which we talked about last time around, The Women, this was required enormous research. There are over 1,000 books written about Frank Lloyd Wright. You know, I read maybe 10 of the best biographies. I traveled to Taliesin, where much of the book is set, and came up with my story. But you have to be very accurate, of course. You know, Frank Lloyd Wright is a cult figure. He has fanatical followers, I had to be absolutely precise and get every detail correct.
Right. Do you prefer that as opposed to the wholly imagined?
Each has its joys. The story from which I just quoted, and you'll forgive me because I can't really do a country accent. It should have had a little bit of a country accent, you know.
Right.
This kind of story is a pure joy. It requires absolutely no research whatsoever. I just lived in this place. I didn't actually meet the people involved, but I kind of know some of the other people up there and have an idea of what they might be like. And here comes the story. So most of them in this, there are few historical stories in the new part of the collection. So really, there are a couple of memory pieces. These are just stories that happen. There's one in here called, for instance, What Separates Us from the Animals. It's narrated by a very chatty, busybody woman who lives on a little island off of Maine. And it came about in this way. I had heard of a little island there in which the people had to get together to get a doctor. They don't have a doctor on the island, so they had to pay the doctor a good salary and give him a house to live in. And so, what would that be like? And in my story, the busybody woman sort of oversees this house, and she sees that the doctor, he's all right as a doctor, but he is a slob, the foremost slob who ever lived. He won't clean up. He doesn't clean the house or the stove. There's grease everywhere. It's a disaster. And she tries to get a maid, but he won't accept the maid. And so what happens? What separates us from the animals? In her mind, cleanliness.
That's fantastic.
Didn't require a whole lot of research. I mean, I have been to such an island and just let it fly.
That's fantastic.
Or the story that follows it is called Good Home, and it's about dogfighting with people who set dogs on one another and bet on it. And it has one of the most chilling endings I've ever written. I just explored this primarily on the internet. What is it? What's the terminology? What do they do? Who are these people? And imagined how it might go. And it's a very dark, disturbing, powerful ending, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Or In the Zone, the one that comes after it. In the Zone. I'm always fascinated by nature. So many of these stories have to do with ecology or with animals or with our relationship to animals. In the Zone, I had read, fascinatingly, that the zone of alienation around Chernobyl from 1986 on to this day is a place where you're not allowed to go. No people are allowed to go there because of the radiation. But in the meanwhile, animals have recolonized it in our absence. Eagles have appeared there, wolves, all these animals that had been exterminated when people were living there. But I also heard that within 3 years of that, they allowed certain people, farmers, peasants, who had lived there all their lives, to go back to their villages. Only a few did, and only people who were old, that is, over 50, because they're going to die anyway. And it was fascinating to me. So I wrote a story called In the Zone about a Russian woman, had been shunted out of there and put in these horrible apartments, going back to her girlhood place in this pristine paradise, which unfortunately isn't so pristine because of the radiation in everything she eats and the air she breathes.
Oh, fantastic. We have drawn down on our time, but thank you so much for coming back on. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
My great pleasure, Marie. Thank you so much.
Thanks again. That was T.C. Boyle. His latest is Stories 2, and San Miguel is now out in paperback. You can find out everything you want to know about T.C. Well, not everything, but you can find out a lot about him at his website, tcboyle.com. That's all the time we have for today. Barbara will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. So thanks again for joining us. Have a great day.